Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Michael Dresser Show. There's no topic this program is afraid to address or investigate, whether it be social, political, or current events, including some very sensitive cultural issues of today. The views expressed by the host, guests, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views of this station. Now, step into the realm of clarity with your host, Michael Dresser.
Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to the Michael Dresser Show. Carol Blackman with us, a newspaper reporter, author, and a speaker, a proud San Franciscan, a native. She studied at San Francisco State University during the Peace and Love era, earned a BA in speech communications from San Francisco State University, and an MA from the Santa Clara University in educational psychology. Carol worked as a newspaper reporter for the Pennsylvania Times Tribune and the San Jose Mercury, that's the Knight Rider, for 16 years. She's written 5 nonfiction books and is working on her 6th book. It's Truth and Love, Finding the Soul of the 60s, and that's going to be due out next year. Carol, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. So nice to be with you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, I go back to the 60s. I remember it well. And I was a product basically of the 50s. I went through grammar school, junior high school in the 50s. And then when the 60s came along, there was a whole different world out there. Where was that transition? What was that common something that changed everything?
Well, I think it was many things that were coming together, and it was interesting. My story is that I was actually here in San Francisco, and my first day on campus at San Francisco State was in 1966. So
oh boy.
I met one of my soon-to-be professors, and at that meeting, he asked me, "What's your major?" I had no idea. And then he asked if I had ever considered something called communications, and I could consider it. No, I had no idea what he meant. So he explained a little bit about how communications included understanding how words were crafted to enlighten and promote. Anyway, I took his introductory class, and I was hooked. And all of his classes, he became my mentor. And in December of 1969, I was finishing up my degree, and I remember chatting with him in the kitchen of a friend's home. It was a department holiday party, and we promised to keep in touch. So years later, I was on campus as a reporter to talk to a class, something like life as a daily newspaper reporter. And I went to the communications office and asked about Professor Gary Hawkins. I'd always planned to meet up with him and compare experiences from the 60s. And when I asked the secretary, she said, "Oh, don't you know? He's dead." Mm. I was stunned. Many of us think about doing things someday, and we just put it off. So I found out that he had died under very mysterious circumstances from a boating accident, which I write about in the book. And since I could not share this experience with him, I went looking for the true meaning of the 60s. You know, San Francisco was the epicenter of so many of our nation's hotly debated issues.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Changing attitudes. You know, this is not really an important book unless you're curious about what really happened. So I have interviewed more than 50 people. The stories I have collected from people who lived through this tumultuous, quirky, funny, poignant time tell the truth about what really happened. And in the end, I believe I have evidence about how our peace and love era changed the world.
I think it absolutely changed the world. I think the problem is the word communication. I really wonder if the message from the 60s was as clear to the people that were participating in it as it was. You got what we don't have, and I think there's the major problem, is commonality of definition. There are people out there demonstrating for things they don't even know why they're demonstrating, and I think that's one of the major problems. Even today, same. It's defining that destination, and I think that was a major problem back then.
Well, I think there was lots of experimentation going on. Obviously, people like Timothy Leary showed up in our Golden Gate Park, and he was suggesting to people that they should, you know, turn on, tune in, drop out. But that was really one portion of it. There was more going on with individuals who were thinking through what they considered normal or acceptable. And it was funny because some people were really challenging the norm. I have one story in the book about Sergeant Sunshine, who smoked pot on the steps of City Hall. This was not a crazy person from the outside view. I mean, Richard Burgess was a 12-year veteran of the San Francisco Police Department, and he'd received a commendation for saving a 13-year-old boy who was drowning. But the experimentation with drugs was something that he embraced. So he
I think in the 60s, just for a minute to jump in, again, I was a product of the 50s. I was born in the 40s, but I grew up as a teenager, et cetera, in the 50s. And now, not that I inhaled, how's that? But going all the way back then, the drugs were, when I was in 11th grade and I graduated in high school in 1960, when I was in, oh, don't tell anybody, by the way, when I was in the 11th grade, marijuana just started to become acceptable. It wasn't a gateway drug to anything. And I think they were, now not that I know this, but I think they were like three for a buck and a half. But when you really, somebody told me that. But when you really come down to it, it was drugs were completely different in those days. I mean, the drugs are drugs, but they weren't as heavy duty as they are today.
Well, we do have a lot more of them, obviously. And the thing was that at that time, it really was an experimentation, and some kids, they were kids at the time, came to San Francisco expecting that that was going to be their experience. But, you know, the 60s was more than that, because it had to do with not making assumptions. You know, on a day-to-day basis, we make assumptions and judgments all the time.
Sure.
But the 60s really asked us to not do that, because you wanted to understand what that person was all about. Do you know that we have an emperor and empress in San Francisco?
No.
Well, let me tell you a little story. On a very foggy day, I attended a celebration of life at a local cemetery. There was quite a crowd of fashionable people, some with huge hats, and they were walking on 5-inch heels. Anyway, they gathered to pay tribute to this character we have from our Gold Rush history, called Joshua Abraham Norton, who had declared himself Emperor of the United States in 1859. He was quite an eccentric, and I write about him. But I noticed one celebrant who was dressed in a black floor-length Victorian gown with a little small hat and a fingertip veil, and she had strawberry blonde curls. I found out later that she was an 85-year-old man named Jose Sari, who in 1965 had proclaimed herself Empress One, Widow of Norton. Of course, they lived in different times, but that was okay. It was illegal to cross-dress in San Francisco at the time. And he was a World War II veteran, and he created something called the Imperial Court. And in 1965, cross-dressing men could be arrested for wearing a dress. So they had a little sign that they used to pin on their dress saying, "I am a boy," which was allowed them to not be arrested. So Jose was one of the first gay activists, and at this grand ball that he staged for his friends, he proclaimed himself Empress. Well, that imperial court has lasted all the way through to today. There are chapters across the country, in fact, in Canada and Mexico, and they raise money for charity. So that group has raised millions of dollars for charity. And again, your assumption would be, well, that's just crazy, or the fact that it's just silliness, they're just dressing up. But in fact, it's resulted in something pretty positive for a lot of charities. So there's an assumption that you could make that you would miss the story if you really didn't understand the rest of that. Now, in other words, other ways, things, you know, that, what is the saying that, you know, as much things change, things stay the same?
Sure.
I mean, one of the things that surprised me again was we now currently have all of these questions about police officers' actions across the country. And we have the Black Lives Matter movement that came out of that time. But that's not new. in back in the 60s, there was something called COINTELPRO. It's an acronym for Counterintelligence Program. And it was actually deemed illegal by the United States Senate because they were accused, the FBI was accused of illegal harassment, intimidation, and violence against the Black Panther Party. Now, you and I may remember the Black Panthers as the big scary guys.
I remember the Black Panthers.
Yeah. But what you may not know is, again, on the assumption part, the thing that did not get attention was they started a whole group of community service programs, and they were one of the first people who did a free breakfast for poor children before school. So I interviewed a Black Panther woman, whose name is Carol also, who came from the San Francisco chapter and worked in that program. And until today, she still gets some young people coming up to her and asking her if she is the woman who drove them to that church to have that breakfast before school. So again,
Carol, let me jump in with that for a moment, because when it comes, you know, and I was there too, but I think really what has occurred, that innocence of fundamental meaning that they had in the very beginning, a lot of those things are changed today based on culture. If we could have kept it the way it was, because their hearts were in what they were doing. You know, you didn't have the race baiters and the people making money off of the separations. And I mean, I don't know. You could talk about this for days. But the point of contention is it started innocent. And I just, there was that transition when it wasn't. It's like with the women's movement in those days. It started and it got stronger. And it was, you know, I think it was wonderful. If you were to ask me what I thought about women's lib, if it means that everybody gets the same shot at something, you know, equality across the board, I'm there. But if it's the subjugation of somebody to get ahead, then I'm on the other side of the table. And those are some of the things we have to look at. The 60s were wonderful with the innocence, the essence of innocence way a lot of these groups were started. It was good.
I'm glad you said women, because did you know that in the 60s a woman could not get her own credit card, could not serve on a jury?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Could not buy a birth control pill, could not attend an Ivy League school. And Governor Brown in California just a couple days ago signed an equal pay law, one of the toughest in the country. But again, we started from something that was a set of lessons for us to learn. I interviewed a woman named Candida Royale, who took that on that equality issue kind of early. She was a porn star in San Francisco in the 60s, and she decided to create her own company. So she produced the films. Women had never done that before. She took charge of creating the entire thing and also making the money through that process. So it was fun to talk to her, because she said that she was scared when she learned that her dad actually saw her talking about her business on a talk show. But later he told her, all you do is bring pleasure to people's lives, and that's nothing to be ashamed of. So she
passed
away.
Yeah, I've got something here.
She passed away about a month ago in New York. Yeah.
I'm digging this out as we're talking to confirm and verify what you're saying. Radio Susie, her late husband worked for the Milk and Ice Cream Drivers and Dairy Employees Union, and it was 1964 to 1967. And on page, let me find this, on page, what was it? It was page 54. I hope this is it. Come on. Where'd it go? I'll find it as we talk. But basically what it says is that a woman can't take a job that a man, that's existing for a man at this moment.
Exactly.
And that was in the union.
Yeah. Well, we forget some of these things. That it's interesting to look back, as I've had to do to research this book, and to find out what was expected to be the norm at the time. And when I tell some of the young people what I've discovered, they say, "You're kidding." Really? That happened then? I said, yes, it actually did. And I'm glad that through my research and through this book process, I'm going to be able to give credit to some of the people who actually started some of these ideas. And they had to be pretty courageous at the time to do it, because it was against the norm and what we thought of or practiced on a regular basis. You know, now the funny thing is we talk about peace and love, and people typically have a reaction of, oh, you know, that was either crazy time or isn't that lovely. But peace and love has not ever gone away, and now we have something called emotional intelligence. Have you heard about this?
Yeah, absolutely.
Emotional intelligence is something business has discovered recently, and I have to chuckle a little bit because I think of it as the peace and love idea that we created through our mechanisms of discovery and experimentation and whatever. But people were focused at least on this idea. So the hippies would, of course, in their daily experiences, promote this concept of peace and love. Well, it's compassion and empathy. And now businesses have found out that actually, if they have young people who have not learned these experiences, they have to actually teach the young people how to relate to another person. It's all the social skills that we expected grandmothers to teach us, you know, our manners and so on. And
sure.
Prior to the development of tech, we communicated face-to-face. Now, and our brains were wired that way, body language, visual cues. We sat at family dinners and we talked. But
sure.
Now,
Carol, I found it. I can multitask. I'm listening to everything you're saying. Okay.
Good.
Article 15, female. The employer shall not employ female help on any identical operation as now performed or heretofore performed by male help. So that was actually in the union contract.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. Well, as I said, this emotional intelligence idea, too, is something that we took for granted because we did all of these things as face-to-face communications. There
sure.
are so many tech devices now that we're using. There was one study that I read that said that 11% of adults prefer to stay home and text rather than meet somebody face-to-face. That shocked me. One study, another study on smartphone owners said, we send and receive more than 4,000 messages a month. Well, if we're busy doing that, we're not talking to one another. So, you know, what is social media really doing to us? There's a question that we have to answer, and it goes back to the 60s and what valuable lessons we can learn from that period in time. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely, no question. But I would love to see those valuable lessons applied say the same thing in a different way with the true essence of what they were really meant to be in the very beginning. You had people with their hearts and souls in this. You know, we live in a world today that we have a lot of political correctness that's stifling so many people.
Yeah.
There's words that you can't say. There's this that you can't do. They're taking the history away. I mean, I can go on and on, you know. But the point is, it wasn't like it is, and I think what happens, it takes away. But, you know, everybody's screaming and yelling, you know, you can't say girl because it's, you know, sexist or whatever the case may be. It takes away from the real essence of a woman's movement. And I think there in and of itself is a problem. It bites itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, like I said, we were very lucky in the fact that just a couple of days ago, the governor of California signed an equal pay bill. And the funny thing was he did it at a museum that's dedicated to Rosie the Riveter from World War II.
Oh, yeah.
So he took he took the current idea, and there were some people there who had actually worked as Rosie the Riveters from World War II, because, as you know, that whole idea of a man's job, he gets precedence and whatever.
Men went to war, and they needed somebody to rivet.
We needed them, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I have to say that I applauded him for using that connection, because I thought that was great to be able to say.
Yeah, by the way, and look at those two women that just passed the special forces. They went through all of the
exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
that doesn't mean everybody can do that, but they did.
No. No. And not everybody wants to do it, and that's okay too. But it's the idea that there's opportunity for all, and I think that was something that was cracked open at the 60s, and of course we've still got much more work to do. So
sure.
Anyway.
But that's the key. It's called opportunity.
Yeah.
You know, and politically, I'm not excited over Hillary Clinton. I never really have been. But if she became president, she wouldn't be a woman anymore. She'd be she'd transition to the most powerful person on the planet.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's not man or woman.
No.
It's that position.
It's the opportunity. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well,
absolutely.
We've come a long way to be very groovy in 2015, and I hope we stay as groovy as we need to be.
No, absolutely. You know, and if you want to know what I'm like politically, ask me who I would like to see as president and vice president. Go ahead, ask me.
Who would you like to see as president and vice president?
Funny you should ask that. John Wayne and the Fonz.
Well, they were
now you know all about me.
Yeah, they were active in the 60s too, so I applaud that. That'll fit right in with this book that I've got coming out a year from now, basically, because in 2017, The Summer of Love will have its 50th anniversary.
Oh, great.
We have a lot of 50.
You wrote it like 4 or 5 years before you were born.
You're so kind. Thank you so much. But no, Truth and Love and Finding the Soul of the 60s is going to be a book for the anniversary of all that people went through during the 60s. And it wasn't all good and it wasn't all bad. It basically was an interesting, quirky time, and we see a lot of connections to what's going on today.
Oh, absolutely. Carol, we're just about out of time now. Can we get your website, where to find you and the books and what you're doing?
Absolutely. I would love to keep in touch with people if they sign up for my mailing list, and it's a weekly blog post. It's all free, a weekly blog post about the 60s, and it's at moretosayfromsf.com.
Wow. Hey, listen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it was a pleasure, Michael. It was interesting and fascinating talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Seems like dreams, like I always had, could be so big, making me glad. Why am I blue? It's up to you to explain.
I'm thinking maybe, baby, I'll go away someday, somewhere. You'll come and say it's you I need, and you'll be pleading in vain.
It had to be you, just had to be you. I wandered around, finally found somebody who.
Welcome back. It's Michael. You're listening to the Michael Dresser Show. This next interview is going to be it's the center of me, the journey to finding your inner coach. And realistically, when you come down to it, we go through life, we look at things, on the outside of us, but we never really look in unless somebody says, look, there's something to look at. Laura Berry with us, longtime resident of Bucks County, Pennsylvania. She's a traveler in A Course in Miracles and both leads and participates in sessions at all levels. A consultant in the business world and also coaches executives, is a sought-after speaker and facilitate retreats for those healing from trauma, illness, or the rigors of life. She's a mom, she's a runner, she's a rower, an interfaith minister, and an all-around funny woman. And she's mostly a student of life, thoroughly enjoys its classrooms, but does not have more formal credentials. And let us say, Laura, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, hi, and thank you.
Oh, thank you for being here. Mind, body, and spirit. I really believe when it comes down to it, if you don't know that all three are working at the same time, there's something missing, and that's going to lead you down those roads to disappointment.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And it's all about the awareness of those three components that are not separate. They are so connected, yes.
Where was it for you? When was it that you actually realized that there were three components? There was more to life than quote-unquote, just the body and the mind.
I think I've had that realization for about as long as I can remember. In fact, as a child, I felt odd because I thought and felt differently than some of my friends and peers did. When I really started to focus on the voice inside our head, the inner coach, that actually started to happen when my children were young, and I would watch them play sports, and I would pay attention to how their bodies would physically react based on what they were telling themselves in terms of getting up to bat or,
yeah,
you know, going on the field. And it so directly had a physical impact on them. And I knew what my mind was communicating to me about them at that time. And a light bulb went off, and I thought, what is it that they are telling themselves at this point in time?
You know, when it really comes down to it, the spirit, it runs in that unconscious mind that we have, which is about 80% of our entire brain power. And most people aren't aware that it's there, but it's there every second of the day, 24 hours a day, and that's what's telling us what to do. If you get into that unconscious mind, it deals in language of pictures and symbols, not English or Spanish or Dutch or whatever that, you know, you speak verbally, but the pictures and the symbols, those things that you recognize and you react to them. And when we tell ourselves things, it's not necessarily verbalizing it, it's this experience of something that we saw and the emotional connection that's tied to it. That's what causes us to react.
Well, you know, and that's a very interesting point. And the journey to finding your inner coach is really about getting to know yourself by paying attention to how it is that you talk to yourself. It's about realizing that our critic voice is usually in control, and it keeps us stuck in blame and guilt and judgment. And in my book, my goal is to gently guide the readers through the process of becoming aware of how powerful our thoughts are and just noticing if we're being supportive to ourselves or we're being derogatory. Maybe are we helping ourselves or are we sabotaging ourselves? But the process is the journey itself, and as you know, this is something that can only be done by you and for you.
You know, I've discovered years ago, we all talk about, you know, destination, and the journey is, you know, the trip, the roadmap there. I don't think there is a destination. I think the entire world is built around the journey. That in and of itself is the real magic, because if you're brought here to learn a lesson, the minute you learn it, you know, your big gift, you know what you get, another lesson.
Yes, that's exactly. That's why I like to say I'm a student of life. And even though I have credentials and I have degrees and all those other kinds of things, I'm really a student of life. And this is the classroom. And it doesn't end. It doesn't. My lessons just continue to come. And if I can look at things happening for me and not to me, then I'm shifting that perception in my mind, right? I'm shifting this from a blame mode, which would be a critic mode, that inner critic, to a coach mode, saying, okay, if this is happening for me, I might not like it, I might not agree with it, but let me approach this with some curiosity and compassion, and that is what can help me get through.
By the way, the word no is probably one of our greatest gifts when somebody says no to us, because it means that there's a door opening up, and if you step on the outside of your experiences, you begin to realize that there's a world out there that you weren't even aware of, even though it was there constantly, you know, 24/7. Great story. There's a woman that I know who wanted to be a professional athlete, and her coach said, nope, you don't have what it takes, you're not good enough, yada, yada. And she wouldn't listen to him. You know, he was telling her no. So she quit him, and she went out and she found a professional coach who taught her. She became a professional athlete and ended up as an adjunct professor of athletics at a university. Now, let's go backwards. The coach that she met, the one guy said no, caused her to go out and find another one. They fell in love. She married the guy. They've been married 20 years now.
Isn't that a great story? That's a great story. And kudos to her, because that's not always what happens, right? So sometimes what happens is that somebody else tells us no, and we believe them. And
yeah,
then their view and their opinion and their judgment, we take ownership of. And this happened to my sister in nursing school at Villanova. And she was able to prove the dean wrong on many levels, but it affected her. It negatively affected her in terms of her studies throughout getting her master's and her nurse practitioner's
yeah.
degree. And so there's different ways that we can perceive what somebody else is saying to us. We can approach it with curiosity and compassion and see if it fits, or we can say, I'm not sure, that's your opinion, thank you, but it's not my opinion of me. But it all starts with...
Let me hold you up. You just, excuse me for the interruption, but you just said it. It's not my opinion of me, it's your opinion of me, which has got nothing to do with me.
Right.
You know, the world is nothing more than a big, you know, mirror out there. And we probably address this 50,000 times a week, and it's true. If somebody doesn't like you, it has nothing to do with you. It's about what they don't like about themselves, and they're projecting it because they're not going to see it. The dean, it had nothing to do with her. It had to do with his own shortcomings and fear of not being able to make it. So what do we get? We do? We shut somebody else down. We feel better about it, and we're strong, and yada, yada. So that's the key. You got to make that separation.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the time we're just on autopilot. We don't challenge our self-talk. We're not challenging if what someone else says about us is true for us. We own things that may or may not be healthy for us.
Yeah.
And you know, psychologists believe that this inner critic starts from early life, and that there are experiences as children, whether it's told directly to us or indirectly to us, that there's something about us that's not acceptable, and we want to be liked. And so as children,
sure,
we start to alter what we do, and we take on other people's personas for ourselves so that we can be liked, that we can be accepted. And it develops into feelings of not good enough. And when we don't question our thoughts and we don't challenge our self-talk and our self-judgment, we're just on autopilot.
It's knowing. Let me give you an example that we probably use 3,000 times a day, okay? But it brings the point home, all right? Ask me if I'm good-looking. Go ahead, ask me.
Are you good-looking?
Funny you should ask that question. You know, absolutely, and if you don't think so, somebody else will. If I had the ability to, if I had five women here right now, and I could stand individually behind each one and look through their eyes to see me, I would see a gorgeous Michael, a homely Michael, an okay Michael, or whatever. And the ones who think I'm homely, there's nothing I can do to change their mind. So you go with the people who think you're gorgeous.
I like your attitude. But that's what it is. You're choosing. You are in control. You're not allowing the negative feedback and the negative thoughts to now take control of you. You're in control. You're not on autopilot. And that's what's important. That's what I mean by the journey to finding your inner coach, is to be able to take the words that somebody else says or the thoughts that somebody else might give you and to see whether or not this is supporting of you or this is sabotaging you. Is it your coaching voice? Or is it your critic voice?
I've always felt that you got two little voices. There's that voice that says, you can't, you can't, you can't. And then if you stop and listen to the one underneath that, it's the one that says, you can, you can, you can.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, little angels on your shoulder. And we talk to ourselves constantly.
Yes, yes. And we have a capacity for both. And it is that the nagging critic is the one that speaks first. It judges, it complains a lot. And I think it's really important to note that the critic voice overrides the coaching voice, especially in the beginning of doing any kind of healing work or self-reflection work, right? The critic voice says things like, I'm not good enough, I'm not rich enough, I'm not successful enough, or whatever. You can fill in the blank. But the concern is when we become so used to the unrelenting negative self-talk or beating ourselves up over something in our past that it begins to actually shape who we think we are, and it molds our self-image. And so the key is to catch yourself in the process, and instead of beating yourself up even more, to hold yourself in a place of compassion and curiosity and see what different words you can use to support yourself.
Sure, Laura, you got to become, and you said it, you got to become aware of it. 100 years ago, in a different lifetime, in a different world, in a different profession, I used to do workshops with people. And I remember one thing that we did, which was kind of fun. we would have everybody, number one, write a blame letter. You know, that person that got of you did this, and because of you, yada, yada, yada.
Yes,
and
yes.
Then, you know, the tears are starting, you know. And then I would say, okay, now let's change something. Instead of you, say I. You know, and it came down to, because I did this to me, this is what happened, yada, yada. And then I'd say, okay, get a partner and sit there and just the worst thing you think about yourself. You know, I don't have a good self-image. I don't deserve it. I'm not worthy. You know all the stuff that goes on. And I said, well, now that you know who you are, just why don't you just go walk around the room and introduce yourself? People are walking around shaking hands. I'm not worthy. I'm no good. Da-da-da. I'm ugly. And the tears would start, and then somebody would start to laugh. And the entire room would explode in laughter, and they began to realize how ridiculous it was because it was underneath. It wasn't something that they would let come to the surface, but it was a safe place to let it all surface where they could take a look at it and say how ridiculous this is.
Absolutely. And that's a really cool exercise that you're talking about doing.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And it is, because when I call that situational happiness.
Yeah.
And it's we get to be the victim, we get to blame, others are always the cause of everything that's wrong in our life, and it doesn't encourage us to actually look inside. And we have, I think, in the society an overemphasis on the externals, right? And that situational happiness means that we need everything outside of ourselves to change in order for us to be happy. And so the blame letter that you were talking about is great, because you actually turned it around so that they could take a look and see, maybe they're in control of some of this. Maybe they're the ones that need to take a look at this and dig a little deeper.
The one thing that I've learned over the years basically is this, that you can't find happiness. You can't. Happiness is inside. You can be in the middle of something absolutely miserable, but happiness is still there. What happens is we mask it, we cover it, and we have to realize that to be happy, to have that certain something about yourself, you don't need anything to make it happen. Because the minute you need it, then all of a sudden, if it's gone, you're back in the same place again. So happiness is inside. All you have to do is just unmask it, realize it's there, and just let it come out and play.
Absolutely. I could not agree more. And I think that it's because our critic mind is judging all that is outside of us as wrong or bad, and we need to change what's outside of us, right? So, but our coaching mind, on the other hand, that will look at the same situation with curiosity, and in that process begin to dig deeper and get to the real cause of our unhappiness. It kind of shifts us away from blaming others for our unhappiness. And I think that this is really scary for some people.
Oh, sure. You dare take a step into the unknown? Oh, I don't think so. Yeah.
Right, but, right.
And then the people who blame God for everything, which I think is very interesting. You know, you're brought to this space, this planet, and you're dealt a hand of cards. It's something called free will. And you get to play them the way you want to play them. And God never says no. You want you want happiness? Yes. You want misery? Yes. You want money? Yes. You want to be broke? Yes. You get to choose. And it's all of those little voices you're talking about from the inside that allow you to be able to make the changes in your world. Because if you don't know what's going on, it's going to capture you. But in spirituality, there's no such thing as no.
Yeah, that's a very interesting way of looking at that, right? Well, and it all starts with awareness that we're even doing it, that we're talking to ourselves negatively, that we're looking outside of ourselves for happiness, that once we are aware of any habit, right, and I think that the negative self-talk is just that, it's a habit, then we can begin to do it differently. And awareness, flat out, is key. And there are exercises to get to the underlying cause of our thoughts and beliefs. But it's just important for us to be able to dig deeper.
You want a great example of awareness?
Go ahead.
You're sitting by a desk?
Mm-hmm, I am.
Touch the desk. Got it?
Okay.
Until you touched that desk, it wasn't there, was it? I mean, the desk, but it wasn't in your awareness. It didn't exist, did it?
You're right. My papers. You're right. You're right.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah.
You
didn't just make it appear, but it wasn't.
It was brought into the forefront of my consciousness.
Yes. Now
right.
It exists.
Right.
And
that
was a little
right.
lesson I learned years ago. I decided to do that. If I start to lose it, I'll tap myself on the chest and bring myself back to me.
I like that. I may have to
borrow
that.
Same thing as tapping the desk. I mean, when you're intentional about your end result, then it works.
Right.
Who was it? I can't remember her name. I interviewed her years and years and years ago. And she wrote a book called What You Think of Me Is None of My Business.
Oh, I've heard of that book. Yes, it's a great title.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's realistically
right.
what it is. You know, when you go out, you know, in the morning, you know, we think that, you know, we do things for ourselves. No, you don't. Why don't you, excuse me for being a little crude, but why is it that when you got up this morning and went out, why did you put clothes on? Because of what somebody else is going to think. I'm not saying don't do, you know, I'm not saying go out into the public without clothes. But we're so concerned about what we think everybody thinks. Do you dress for you? Do you dress for this? Now, underneath it, you do. But when you come down to it, it's you're thinking about how you're going to affect others' opinion of you.
Well, there are some societal norms that we have that we all buy into, right? Like, and it helps to prevent chaos. So we all agree in America we're going to drive on the right side of the road. And when we don't, then there's the possibility that chaos happens. And so there are some things that we do collectively agree to in terms of what we're going to, how we're going to show up in the world.
Sure.
However, there's so much that we do that we don't even know that we've agreed to. We're on autopilot. And we're on autopilot with our thoughts because some thoughts will support us and some thoughts will sabotage us. Right? Like we had discussed earlier, the I'm not good enough, I'll never be thin enough, I'm not rich enough, right? If we are not questioning the thoughts that sabotage us, how we feel about ourselves becomes negative, and then that negativity creates suffering. And then we don't get to live up to our highest potential because we're believing the sabotaging or negative thoughts. And that nagging critic is the one that speaks first. It speaks more loudly, and it has prime time in our thoughts more so than the coaching voice. And this is an issue because our emotions are created by our thoughts and not by our circumstances. Right?
So absolutely, no question about it.
And because a circumstance, it just is. You know, traffic just is, but it's our interpretation then that makes it unpleasant. It's how we judge our circumstances and our surroundings that creates that unsettledness within us. And when we do not question our thoughts and we have negative feelings or emotions, or we don't then feel well, or we don't behave well, we don't show up as our best self, and that's when we suffer. And it all, as we've said a zillion times, it all starts with the awareness that we're even doing it, because it's a habit. And once you start paying attention to it, you'll be surprised at how it's nonstop chatter in your mind.
Sure. Now, we could talk about this all night, but we're just starting to run out of time. So let me ask you this. Website we can find you at, find a book, and follow along with what you're doing.
Sure. So my website is www.laurabarry.org, my name, laurabarry.org. The book is called The Center of Me, The Journey to Finding Your Inner Coach. And the last piece of information I'll say, you know, do you remember those old L'Oreal commercials? And they would end with that beautiful tagline, because you're worth it. So I say, be your own L'Oreal commercial. Think highly of yourself. Speak highly of yourself to yourself, because you are worth it.
Absolutely. And by the way, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Okay, take care.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Just to be stuck thinking of you.
Kelly! Howard! Quiet!
Mother's eyes.
Never seen
I ain't never seen
Howard, don't. I'm on the air. Quiet.
Oh,
you can hear everything that's going on in
here.
Welcome back, Michael. You're listening to the Michael Dresser Show. Gabriella Kovac with us, the author of Georgina Holocaust Survivor Stories. And let us say, Gabriella, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much, Michael, and thank you for having me. It's amazing to talk
my
to
pleasure,
the U.S.
My goodness. You know, when it really comes down to it, a Holocaust we live 24/7, you know, it's constant. It may not be as vicious and violent as it was when it was going on, but if the world is not careful, we're going to end up being in a very similar situation.
That's exactly right, Michael. That is one of the main reasons I wrote the book, because it is a Holocaust story, but it applies to today. It applies to every minute of every day from at all times.
No, and you've seen it. You know, we talk about it, but you were there. You lived through the Hungarian uprising against the communists, 1956, and the Russian tanks, you know, under your bedroom windows. You've seen these things that most people here in America, we hear about it, but we haven't seen it. So we're not going to get that effect. Like, you were there. You've done that. And I think it's very important to get the kind of message out, because if we're not careful, we'll have the same thing going on.
That's right. That's why I keep saying that's why I wrote the book, because to get out of something like that. And, you know, it's with you. And I cannot tell you how long after, when we even were in a free country, that suppression is still there. It takes a while to get used to the fact that, no, you are now free.
Yeah. And I think that's something else, too. We have to define what freedom is, because, you know, we hear the word and we think we're free, but if you don't define it, if you don't have the guidelines to realize what it is that you have, you don't know that you're missing it, and you don't know when it's being taken away.
You're absolutely right. And I look at it today and what's going on in the world, and I think, I wish my mother was around. She'd sort of show them what to do again. She was just such an incredibly powerful being, and lived without fear at all times. Or she had one of the most amazing sayings, which we know, like these sayings are with us all the time. She used to say, a dog can smell fear and it will bite you. Don't show fear.
No, absolutely. And I think when you really come down to it, let's go back to this right before the Second World War. Germany, right about the time Hitler was taking over, they were going through almost the same thing as we here in the United States are going through. There was a division. They lost their identity. They lost who they thought they were, and there was a lot of confusion. And I think that's what's happening in the world today. You've got these cultures and subcultures within the cultures, And nobody can define, you know, what's an American anymore, what's a this, what's a that, you know, what's a Russian. And when you come down to it, if you can't define who you are, the identity's gone. And once that identity's gone, there's a weakness there, and you're taken over.
And you're taken over by the wrong leaders, because
yes,
they promise you something that they can't deliver, and what they deliver is suppression.
Yeah, absolutely, because when you really come down to it, we move towards what we can identify with. You know, we call it family, and where you're going to be accepted, etc. Look at the kids during the Second World War. You know, the brown jackets, and they were going out and killing people and whatever. Why? Because it was something that you did to be accepted and have the identity of whatever it was at the time. That's extremely important to realize. Look at the world today. The people who will go out and kill themselves for a cause, blow themselves up. I mean, you know, the list goes on and on. Why? Because as they're doing that, they're being accepted by a particular group. That's what we have to look for.
You're right. And if we have our own identity, and that's what I did. Really, that was one of the main reasons, because, you know, in the darkest times of my life, even afterwards, my mother's thoughts have given me strength, and all
yeah,
the things that she used to say, and that's why I thought, that's one of the main reasons that I wanted people to understand that there is something that sort of, if you look at it, it isn't, but it sort of verges on the supernatural of believing within yourself that you are, and you can achieve anything. And we all can. We're all very powerful beings. We can all achieve everything we ever wanted.
How
it's
scary was it for
to
you
that.
To live? How scary was that for you to live through those incidences?
Do you know the most scary thing was? Not the tanks were frightening, but there was one night when we had this huge bay window and this lady was sitting in front of it knitting, and we thought that they were firing from us out. But in the morning, when we went down and we could see the shrapnels hanging on the fences, like it was, you know, like the icicles,
yeah,
and ours was about the only block up. That's when it was scary. That's when
wow,
I was really scared.
You know,
because
you know,
what could have happened?
We go through life, and we hear about these things, and they're frightening, and they're, you know, they're scary. But until you live it, you know, and I never have, thank goodness. But until you live it, that's a whole different dimension of experience of what this world not so much has to offer, but what can do. And there are people out there that will totally take advantage of it. Let me ask you this. The purpose of the book, I pick it up as a reader. I read it page by page, cover to cover. What do I get? What do I, Michael, as the reader, get? What do I take away, walk away with when I finish the book?
That to think outside the square, that's what the purpose is. That the incidents are mentioned and then what the solutions were for each incident. And like there was one incident when the police came to take my mother away, and I was 4 years old and was absolutely petrified. Because they were
sure
questioning me. Can you imagine being questioned by a secret police at 4?
No.
And my grandmother and my father were in the room, and they didn't say anything. Then my mother walked in, and she looked at them straight in the eye and said, "Put that child down." And you know they did.
Yeah. Enough strength. You know,
and that's what I'm trying to get
yeah
across in the book. No fear, and do what you need to do. When that inner voice says run, no, stay and handle.
What kind of upbringing did your mom have, your mother, to make her like this? Where did she get that strength from?
Her father, and I start the book with that. Her father was a brilliant man, and he kept telling her that she was beautiful, intelligent, and she was in a magic bubble and nothing will harm her. And she believed it. It's amazing. I have never, ever seen anybody, it's not even a belief, it was a knowledge that was the truth for her. And it was her truth that she was in a magic bubble and nothing will harm.
You know, realistically,
amazing.
We can live that way. And that's a very high possibility, because that magic bubble can be the people that are around you to protect you. That magic bubble can be the culture in which you live that allows you to move forward and be who you are. You know, so that magic bubble is really there.
Of course it is. It's within every one of us. We just need to look for it, and it's there. And you just need to find it and believe in yourself, and there you are. You're in a magic bubble.
Yeah. No, absolutely. No question about it. And I really believe, when it comes down to it, it's what you believe about yourself. You know, there are people who survived the Holocaust, you know, and there's, you know, and there are a lot of people who didn't. But I think the people who survived had that certain something within that allowed them to move forward.
That's right. And that's the people. That's what I'm thinking of. Because most of the books that I've seen and read are about people that have a tattoo on their arm who have actually suffered. And I don't want to take anything away from that, because you need to respect it and understand it. But when you have somebody who thinks outside the square and think, well, if they tell me to wear this star, how about if I don't? How about if I just color my hair blonde and get smart enough and get a false passport? What would happen then?
Yeah. No, absolutely. No question about it. I really believe, you know, in life, if you take those same principles, those same beliefs, that same strength, it will lead you to places that you normally couldn't have got to.
I cannot tell you how right you are. You're really speaking from my heart. It's exactly what I feel. That the more you believe in yourself, doors you wouldn't believe will open. If you have that ability, doors will open. Things will happen. And it's magic.
No question. And that's the key. You just have to know that it is going to happen. And most people are frightened to death. We're afraid of what somebody's going to think. We're afraid if we do step out there and we don't know what to do, you're going to get hurt emotionally, physically, whatever the case may be. It's just called just do it.
Exactly. Just do it. What's the worst that can happen? They laugh at you?
Oh, wait a minute. There's your next book. Just do it. Oh, well,
I'm actually writing another book, but a different story again, because I've examined the Balkan Wars and what happened there, because that's a really confusing area of the world. So I wanted to do something and do some investigation on that, and then I will write another book about me.
You're talking about in the Balkans when the English, they went to war in the early 80s?
No. I'm going to dive back again to the Second World War, because that was such a messy time. Yeah.
Yeah, I was, you know, I was born around then, but I was, you know, I was a baby, who knew what. But did leave an impact, and obviously war does. And I really believe that we live in wars socially. We live in wars in every country that we're in. And it seems as though the world has got to a point where survival is so critical for everybody.
Yes. And we need to I do hope the message does get across and that people do pick up my book about Georgina and read it, because it's just what it is. It's the truth. It's getting out there, getting your self-confidence back.
No, absolutely. Or creating it if you don't have it. You know, it's like the reset button on your life if you really listen to it and have the experience of what it's like to be able to live through something like that. Because we live through those experiences every day. Symbolically, there is a tank under so many people's bedroom windows every day. Symbolically. You know, and it's just to know that you can get through it. You can make it through.
Yeah, it's you know, it's a great philosopher, I can't think of who, said once, even if you feel fake being happy, and you will be, it's just to have that attitude, that mindset, that show it, and it will occur.
And I think one of the things that you can attest to, you know, you better than I've traveled, but not like you have. If you go from country to country, when you get beyond the politics, when you get to the people, They're the same people.
Yes.
The wants, the desires,
exactly.
The fears, the strengths, the rest of it. People are people no matter what you go, what language they speak, or where you've been brought up. It's based on, you know, the models that cause us to be who we are as we grow and become aware of things. But I've been, you know, to a few different countries over the years, and there's no difference between right here in the United States and anywhere else in the world with people.
You're right. People are people, and they're wonderful, and each one of us have a fabulous story to tell, and they're very precious, and without us, this planet would not exist.
Oh, absolutely. Where are you calling in from?
I'm calling in from Australia, would you believe, Sydney?
Aha, okay. Yes. You know, but there, that's the whole key. Here we, you know, don't you love it with the modern whatever, thousands of miles away, and we're right here. But, and Australia is wonderful. Australia, oh, 10, 15 years ago, was kind of like America was in the 1800s, like the old West, you know, and building and becoming. Yeah. And it's a little different now, and I know, you know, quite a few Australians. And by the way, I think it's a wonderful country.
Oh, it's a magnificent. It's beautiful. It's one of the most beautiful places in the world to live in.
See, I can hear the difference. I can hear every once in a while, you'll have kind of a Russian accent, but the Australian will pop up in there. I can hear both of them working.
Well, I lived here for most of my life, and I do consider myself more of a Sydneyite than anything else. I'm definitely an Australian, but I'm definitely in love with Sydney. Sydney is magnificent. The harbour, the opera house.
I can't imagine anything else
in the world like that.
Okay, now we're starting to run out of time, so let me ask you this. Website we can find you at and get the book.
Well, our website is www.gabriellakovac.com. And
wonderful.
The book is called Georgina, Holocaust Survival Stories, and you'll find it on Amazon. You can download it as a book or as an e-book.
Wonderful. And by the way, thank you so much for joining us today.
It has been an absolute pleasure, and I'm really, really pleased that you had me on your show, Michael.
Oh,
thank you.
My pleasure. Okay, take care. And by the way, when the other books come out, come back to us.
Are they fine?
Okay. I said when you start writing your other books, come back to us.
I will. I will definitely let you know, Michael, when I've got the other two books done. First of all, I do want this to be a movie, though. If you go onto my website, there's already a short on it.
Okay. All right. And by the way, thank you so much again for being here. And have a wonderful evening.
Thank you very much. And the same to you. And bye now.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Special person.
Very special.
be a person who needs people. People who need people.
Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to the Michael Dresser Show. Dr. Jim Roach with us, MD. He's a speaker. He's a consultant, an educator, a researcher, and widely sought clinician with patients from across the country, one of the world's leading integrative medicine experts. He's the author of God's House Calls. And let us say, Jim, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, great to be on.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. You know, there's a word that we're going to start with. And the word is spiritual. Can you define it in such a way that the average person can wrap their arms around it? Because it is so critical that there's an awareness of what you're talking about.
It's a great question, and thanks for asking that. Spiritual applies somewhat to religion, but really it extends beyond religion. It's kind of a connection between all of the religions. And thinking about quantum physics and understanding that we're just energy fields. You know, Einstein said E equals MC squared, that we look at each other, we see solid mass, but in reality, we're just energy fields. And so it's the awareness that we're 99.9% hot air and, you know, particle wave, we're constantly switching back and forth, and that our spiritual energy field can disconnect and reconnect, and when, with near-death experiences, that's exactly what's happening. You know, that spiritual energy field is hovering up above while the doctor does CPR down below. And so spirituality ties into our connection to the spiritual energy fields, to the universe, to God is the way I term it, but others don't use that terminology.
No, it's the way you term it, and it's the way you should term it. You know, that it's called be proud of what you feel. When it comes down to it, I think it was, many years ago, I interviewed Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, and we were talking about when someone dies, and at the hospital, there's that when the moment they pass away, there's that essence, and there's actually a weight that leaves the body. It's slight, but there is a change. And when
absolutely. Yeah, that's been documented.
Yeah. Yeah, and if somebody can believe
and Elizabeth, the other thing Elizabeth Kubler-Ross documented was, you know, she did 2,000 interviews of near-death patients, and blind patients who were hovering up above could see every detail, could hear, or could verify every color that they saw when they came back down. And that's what my patients who have had spiritual near-death experiences, they report the other realm is more real in this realm, and they get mad about coming back, and they're not afraid of death anymore, and it's no longer a matter of faith. You know, they don't have faith that God exists, just like I don't have faith that I'm talking to you at this moment. I know that I am, and those individuals know that they've encountered God or the ultimate, you know, universal essence.
Oh, absolutely, because when you really come down to it, we see it constantly. We see it all over, but you've got to be able to recognize it, and I think that's where the key. Now, you recognized it with a lot of the female patients with the premonitions, the intuitions, the voices, visions, out-of-body experiences, but as a doctor, I can imagine you would be closer to it and see it more and more, because I would say the women were very aware of what was going on with them.
Yeah, there's something about estrogen and intuition, and I find that the higher the estrogen level, the more intuitive individuals are. And so, you know, literally half of my upbeat, serene female patients, those are the ones that you want as your best friend, your next-door neighbor, have a story to tell. And they may not have told anyone else. They may not have told their spouse. They're afraid the spouse won't believe them, and they don't want to be sent to a psychologist or in a mental institution. You know, Lily
sure.
Tomlin said, whoever, you know, when you speak to God, it's called prayer. When God speaks to you, it's called schizophrenia, right? So,
yeah,
but the outcomes of these experiences are really positive for these individuals, and that's how you kind of differentiate. You know, it positively impacts their life from that point forward.
Now, you had a near-death experience. What was that like for you?
Well, I haven't had a near-death experience, but I've had some fascinating things happen in my life. For example, someone who's had three near-death experiences, and I find the more near-death experiences you've had, the more intuitive you become tied in with that. So someone showed up at my office who was able to tell me about an event I'd planned but hadn't shared with anyone, and told me, you know, this is important because, you know, there's someone who had clued me into this. I was having doubts about having a conference in a month from then that I'd organized. I had not had many people sign up. And she said, this force that caused me to move from Arizona to Kentucky, and it caused me to travel to Ashland, Oregon, to try to seek answers, says that this is a very important event. And she described where the event was going to be, even though I'd not announced it. And, you know, that was one thing. I've had many others. I've had individuals channel my mother while I was in the Sunday school class on near-death experiences presenting. A lot of fascinating experiences.
I had an interesting experience once. My mom passed away in 93, and everybody was there, you know, at the funeral, et cetera. So, and my brother had lived with her for many, many, many years. And he came over to my place to stay. And so there was my ex-wife, myself, my brother. And I was in the kitchen, and I was going to change a light bulb. So I'm standing up on this chair to change the light bulb, and I started falling backwards. And I got about maybe a half a foot or a foot away from the floor, and my fall stopped. Now, I could have gotten hurt, but, yeah, she was watching. She,
yes.
She's taking care of me. Yeah.
Oh, you know. Right. So that's why I wrote this book, God's House Calls, because, you know, these stories are, you know, a Hollywood writer couldn't come up with some of these stories. They're so amazing. You know, God's very creative. God has, you know, a lot of personality, I found. For example, you know, one of my mentors, Dr. Dwight McKee, who's the top integrative oncologist in the country before he retired last year. You know, he had, when he was practicing integrative medicine, he had succeeded with an end-stage lymphoma patient. Then that patient's daughter got lymphoma, but she died of chemotherapy side effects. He went home dejected, woke up in the middle of the night, and went to the bathroom, came back to bed, and heard a voice. And the voice said, you were to bring compassion back to hospitals. And he kind of knew what that meant. He was toying with going back to an oncology program. He said, for how long? And the voice said, 4 years. And then he said, who are you? And a giant party favor, about 6 feet long, falls from the ceiling with a lot of energy on the end of it. Here he's trembling in bed. He says, okay.
Sure.
And then it goes right back up. You know, you can't invent these things. And this is the most serious guy and the smartest guy that I've ever met in my life who's sharing this story. It just blew me away.
Now, by the way, it seems as though, and I'm looking at some of the things that you wrote, it seems as though a lot of children with disabilities, a lot of people who have been sick, a lot of people who are close to the edge really experience these things. It seems as though the average person that nothing's wrong with them, quote unquote, doesn't seem to get the experiences often.
Right. Well, you know, it's my belief that God cares a lot about children. Okay. And so when children have issues, you know, when they're traumatized for one reason or another, or if they have disabilities, what I inevitably find is that they've been given a spiritual gift to compensate that for that situation. And so when a mother brings in a disabled child, I will share that with her and say, listen, this child, you know, undoubtedly has been given a gift. So, you know, pay attention, focus on that. And, you know, at least half the time they will share, oh, actually, you're right, and will tell me about their particular gift. There was one child that was in, a few weeks ago at my office, and he is intellectually disabled, but he says, I'm always about 8 steps ahead, and, you know, like in a chess game. He knows what's going to happen 8 moves ahead.
Yeah.
So precognition, in essence, it was his gift.
And by the way, and I think that we all have all of these gifts that we're not aware of, But then all of a sudden, when you need it, it shows up. Because this isn't something just for certain people. This is within all of us. If, you know, there's a spirituality within all of us, that essence of what God is based on, you know, what you think it's like. And that's really where the key is. And it can come in all shapes and forms and all degrees.
Absolutely. That's what I'm learning. And that's the important message that I'm trying to get out with this book. And, you know, we need to destigmatize. And, you know, when God interacts with us, you know, it's not a big secret. We need to share that information and stories with other people. And the more we share it, then the more they can tune into their own intuitive abilities and learn to grow that and have a much richer life because of that.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, when it comes down to it, we all have intuitive abilities. But, you know, in this world, it's so fast-paced. What's going to happen tomorrow? What happened 3 weeks ago? If only, woulda, coulda, shoulda, and all those things. We don't sit down and take the time to allow ourselves to experience and feel what we can. And there's a tremendous amount out there.
Absolutely. You know, prayer, meditation, you know, we've got to stop. And the more people are go, 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 the more important it is for them to stop and rest. We've got to balance our lives. We've got to live in the here and now and not live in the past or live in the present. You know, if we're rushing, that means we're living in the future. And we've got to not live in the future. We've got to enjoy every moment.
No, and by the way, that's absolutely true, because if you could live your life where tonight at midnight it was over for you, you know, rhetorically, how different would your life be? How important would the things that you're concerned and worried about now be? They wouldn't be. It'd be a whole different world. And we don't know that tonight could be the end of it. You could walk out the door and get hit by a train, quote unquote. And so it's called live the life. Live it.
Right. And that's what my patients have taught me. You know, I don't need to fear death because I'm making the world a better place with my health practice. We're doing things that are integrative health practice that, you know, few other doctors in Kentucky certainly, but even beyond, are able to do. I feel good about, you know, the contributions I made. So if something happens today and I die, you know, the downside is ultimate bliss. That's what my patients are sharing. That's what I tell my new cancer patients when they come in. I say, listen, if you've made the world better, you know, and if I do everything wrong and you do everything wrong, the downside is ultimate bliss. And that puts them in a peaceful healing mode so they can recover from their cancer.
No, absolutely, because when you really come down to it, it's the fear and the stress that blocks the immune system and doesn't allow it to do its job. And when somebody's diagnosed, you know, with that, you know, cancer, they're stressed, they're uncomfortable. I remember, 18, 20 years ago, I got sick, and I had to have an operation. And I remember I thought, well, I'm going to get in the best physical condition I can possibly be in to make this operation successful. So I'm sitting in the garage on a stationary bike, and I'm pedaling away and sweating. And, you know, I made it, Jim, I made it okay to die. I didn't say I wanted to die. I said I made it okay to die. The minute that happened, the stress went. And I think my immune system kicked in, and that's probably what saved me.
Yeah, and that's what I'd like to do with all my patients, teach them that they don't need to fear death. And by not fearing death, then they can recover more rapidly because of that. Now, you know, I had an alcoholic patient, and his experience was different. You know, he had a negative near-death experience. He didn't tell me what that was. You know, sometimes they're quite negative in terms of heading south, but, you know, sometimes there are life reviews. You know, your entire life flashes in front of your eyes in a matter of seconds, and you feel those intense emotions for both the good and bad things that you did. But whatever it was, it shook him up. For the next 2 years, he did everything to try to make amends. You know, two children he'd abandoned. He set up trust funds for them. Then he had another spiritual near-death experience. This time it was blissful. So maybe it does matter, you know, how we live our lives.
Oh, I'm no, absolutely.
And Finley also, Dr. Sam Cornea, you know, in New York, had written a book and noted that, you know, individuals that attempt suicide, you know, he said, do not attempt suicide, because most of those individuals have, you know, negative near-death experiences.
It's interesting because what I just got out of what you just said is, if you commit suicide, all of those emotions that cause you to be with that end result, you're going to take with you.
Yeah, Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think, you know, these individuals have a lot of work to do on the other side, you know, if they commit suicide.
So, yeah.
They need to spare them all of that effort.
How can there not be another side? And when I say that is if, you know, if somebody dies, the consciousness can't just be over. You don't come here and you go. There's got to be something to it. And I think the biggest problem that we have is we try to define death. Many, many, many years ago, I was in California, and I was brought up in Los Angeles, and I'm out at Huntington Beach. I'm on the beach. I'll never forget this night. And it's a very warm night. It's dark out. There's got to be, you know, a billion stars in the sky. It's just absolutely gorgeous, wonderful. And I'm looking up, and I'm starting to think, well, gee, what's beyond that? And then what's beyond that? And how can, you know, the galaxy end, and what's beyond that? I actually went way beyond what my linear mind could handle. I scared myself. Okay.
I mean, that
was, and then what I got out of it months later basically was this, that it's not definable based on the knowledge that we have. And how can anybody define the undefinable? And when we talk about spirituality and God, et cetera, when they start to define it, how do you define God? How do you define spirituality? How do you define, rhetorically, how do you define any of these things when it goes way beyond your ability to comprehend what the full spectrum of it is?
Yeah. You know, we try to put God in a box, and God doesn't fit in that box in any way, shape, or form.
No.
And, you know, my book, anyone who reads it with an open mind, there's no way you can read this book and not come to the firm conclusion of the reality of God. You just can't. These stories, one after the other, you know, over 200 stories, there's absolutely, you know, I'm 100.00% certain. And for someone coming out of medical school whose left brain expanded and right brain just shriveled up, that's a big transformation.
Sure. No question it is. Because it's getting out, and science is provable. And, I mean, that's the whole key to science. But the problem is we move through life on assumption. And assumptions sometimes have, Carl Jung said it, incontestable conclusions. And you live your life based on an assumption, and that's not real life.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, my facts have gone topsy-turvy since over the last 3 to 4 years because of my patients. They've been a wonderful gift.
But the patients were what it caused it to be provable. That's the whole point.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not just something that you're assuming is happening. They're proving it to you. You're seeing it over and over again. Not like you just saw it once or twice. You know, there's consistency here.
Right. For example, another quick story. I had a patient in who had, growing up, her mother didn't take care of her very well. So there was another woman who's kind of her mentor who really nurtured her through her life. They were very close. One morning she woke up at 1:10 in the morning. She had this vision of this woman riding a choo-choo train through her front yard, leaning out, waving, toot, 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 toot. And then when she woke up, she learned that's when this woman had died. And then she went to the funeral, and the greeter, she told the story to the greeter. She was so impressed by the story. And the greeter held up four fingers and said, "You're the fourth person with the identical story," right? You know, these stories just are so affirming.
Sure. Oh, no, absolutely. No question about it. And I really believe when it comes down to it, it's like somebody having an operation. I think years ago they said to the doctors, don't talk when you're doing the operation. Don't say this looks good, that looks bad, because they can hear you. You know, there's a whole consciousness going on, and that's the same thing you're dealing with, the near-death experiences and the spirituality. I just, you know, if it's there, you let it be, let it work its way through. And because I really believe in my heart of hearts, the only way something happens is if it's meant to happen. Otherwise, it's not going to happen.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Completely concur there. Yeah.
And as a human, we can be – go ahead.
Yeah, I was talking with a plastic surgeon who was interviewing me on the radio, and she said while she was doing surgery, she felt a presence looking over her shoulder watching everything she did.
Yeah.
And so after the surgery, she asked the patient, "Were you awake during the surgery? Did you watch?" And she said, "Oh, yeah, I watched every detail. It was very nice." But it was very disconcerting for that surgeon.
Yeah, sure, sure. You know, when it comes down to it. Okay, we're just about out of time now, so let me ask you this. website, your website, where we can find you, get the book at.
Yeah, www.godshousecalls.com. Or you can go on Amazon, either way, to reach my book. And it's thoroughly entertaining and also very enlightening as well. It's a great Christmas gift.
Great. And by the way, Jim, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on. I greatly appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I'm Michael Dresser.
My lover stands on golden sand and watches the ship that goes.
And again, I'm Michael Dresser.
Hi, this is Jim Roach.
Oh, hey, Jim. How's it going?
I thought
we were disconnecting. I think we're still on.
This is okay. Radio Susie.
Yeah. Hi.
Okay. All right.
Okay. I can hang
Radio
up for
Susie.
Sure.
Yeah, we're good. Okay. Thanks, Jim.
Okay. Bye-bye.
And that, my friends, is...
It's a Wrap.